We are glad to have everyone tonight. We're glad to have our visitors. We're really happy to have you here to join with us in the study of our lesson tonight. It was about five months from now, it will have been 46 years ago that I began preaching every Sunday. And at the time that I began preaching every Sunday, I was sharing the preaching duties at a little place called Newburgh, Alabama, which was east of Russellville. And so Benji Norris would preach and teach the class Sunday morning, and then I would preach the lesson Sunday evening. And so I would go over for the Sunday morning services, and then I would spend the afternoon over there, and I would just spend the afternoon down at the little building. And so I would spend that afternoon studying for my lesson Sunday night. And then it wasn't long before I was doing both the Sunday morning and the Sunday night, because Benji moved out of the area. And my Sunday mornings were never quite as good as the Sunday nights, because I had the Sunday afternoon to do the studying for Sunday night. I always enjoyed Sunday nights. I still enjoy Sunday nights. All right, I believe that's the one we're going to start with. I'm going to go back to it. This is the way I planned it. I want to talk to you tonight about God's promises. And we're going to look at that map here in a minute. All of God's promises are good. God promises nothing that is only mediocre. All of His promises are good. Promises nothing that's just mediocre. Heaven, eternal life, salvation are all sublime. The Bible records many promises that God has made, and every one of them is something good. So I want to start off with this idea right here. God does not promise anything that is halfway. He doesn't promise anything that is merely mediocre. Many people today have gone to modern day Israel and have said, "Why would anyone want the land of Canaan?" I've had a number of people make that remark to me, people who have been over and seen the land, and I've had them say, "Why would anyone want the land of Canaan?" And they say this because many parts of it are dry and desert-like. Now I want to go back to that map just a minute. Notice this point here. By the way, I want you to know I'm not incompetent, because on my program, I had carefully put the slides in the right order. Why it did this, I don't know. But anybody that's dealt with computers is used to that. Who knows why they do what they do? It's sure not the operator. All right, now then. I want to look at that map for just a moment and show you a few things. I wonder if there... Yeah, let me see if I can use the laser. Yeah, all right. We're in business. All right, now this is a geographical map showing the physical features of the land of Palestine. Now, running right along here, you've got a ridge. And you'll notice that we've got a zone running along here, and then a second zone here, and a third zone there, and a fourth zone there. These are all parallel zones here. And running right down the part of the country is this ridge, a mountain. Over here is the Dead Sea, 1,292 feet below sea level. It is the lowest point on the face of the earth. In the Western Hemisphere, the Death Valley is the lowest point. But the world, the Dead Sea, is the lowest point. And so here's the Jordan Valley that flows. The Jordan flows down this, coming into the Dead Sea down here. Now, it is common for weather to make out of the Mediterranean. The water evaporates from the Mediterranean Sea and is then blown, the moisture-laden wind is blown over here onto the shore. And the coastline is maybe 300-400 feet in elevation, rolling hills. But as you get to this area right along here, which is called the Shephelah, that's the foothills. And as you, the elevation is rising, it continues to rise until you get up to the highest point right in here. As that air mass is moved this way toward the east, it rises. That means that the air is compressed. As the air is compressed, it drops the moisture in the form of rain. And it drops that moisture over here on the west side of that ridge. Now, when that air mass goes over this ridge, then it's as if the bottom drops out from under that air mass. And suddenly it's expanding. And that means that it's absorbing moisture instead of dropping moisture. Therefore, on this side, on the west side of that ridge, you've got rain and you've got grass, foliage, all kinds of things. On this side, you've got the wilderness of Judea, and it pretty well goes up and down here, and you've got a lot of this dry, rugged area running right along in here. But in the bulk of that land, from at least Beersheba north, you have a lot of areas, and this is one of the prize ones up here in Esdraelon or Jezreel. You've got an awful lot of really fine land. And up here in the north, you can see pictures of that lower Galilee, and it's just grass, and you see flowers, just unbelievable flowers growing all out here in the Valley of Jezreel, except where they do have it farmed, and they've got an awful lot of it farmed. So, the wilderness of Judea is a very dry, rugged area. It was in David's day when he fled from Saul. But that's just a part of the land here. And so you have a great deal of this land that is a wonderful, beautiful land. And in fact, you notice right in here, around Jericho, this was the city of palm trees. It was an area, there was an oasis there. And it was a very, the foliage was very luxuriant, everything like that. All right, now I wanted to give you a kind of a little bit of a survey. And then let me get back to where we were. So many people today have gone to modern-day Israel and said, why would anyone want the land of Canaan? And they say this because parts of it are dry and desert-like. Now, either God promised this land knowing that it was not a very good land, but it was the best He could get hold of for Israel. How does that sound? That doesn't sound very good to me at all. That God promised this land, knowing that it was not a very good one, but it was the best He could get hold of for Israel. Or He does not know what a good land is. That God does not know what a good land is. So we're looking at a choice here. Either God promised the land, knowing that it was not a very good one, but the best He could get hold of for Israel. Or God does not know what a good land is. Or something happened to a once good land. Now, as you ponder those three alternatives to explain this feeling that many have today when they go over and they come back saying, I don't know why anybody wanted that land. Which one of those alternatives are we going to take? And the thing I'm concerned about is we have to be careful about those alternatives. Because what impression would be left if we took the first one? God promised the land, knowing that it was not a very good one, but the best He could get hold of for Israel. In view of what we're going to look at in the Bible, it would not reflect very favorably upon God for Him to have said that. The second alternative he just doesn't know what a good land is. That would certainly reflect very unfavorably upon God. Or something happened to a once good land. So the first choice reflects on the ability and the power of God. The second reflects on his intelligence. But what does the third imply? And that's an interesting part of our lesson tonight as we study it. Okay, so you can look with me now at some passages as we move along in our lesson. God first promised the land to Abraham to his descendants. This is Genesis 12 and verse 7. This is where the third of three promises made to Abraham is found. Genesis 12, 1 through 3, and Genesis 12 and verse 7. So God promised the land of Canaan to Abraham to his descendants. So in Genesis 12 and verse 7, the land is added to the three, so that that makes up the three promises God made to Abraham: the nation promise, the seed promise, and the land promise. So God first promised the land to Abraham, that is, to his descendants, or to his seed. Now Abraham lived in that land for 100 years. For 100 years. If it was a worthless land, Abraham should have known that, and he should have pointed that out to God. We would have expected Abraham to make some such comment about that. Lord, here you've promised this land to my descendants after me, but it's an absolutely worthless land, and I don't know, I don't consider that any great big deal. But that's not Abraham's reaction. Abraham lived in that land as if it were a great gift that God was going to give to his descendants. Now, it is true that even in Abraham's day, the land in the south, down in what is called the Negev, was arid, had to have wells dug. But even then and even now, with water, it was fertile and would grow crops. But the land north of the south, or Negev, was a rich and good land. So I want to look now at the descriptions of the land found in the Bible. All right? We're just going to look at the scriptures. Exodus 3. Now this is God. I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of the land unto a good land and a large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey. Now that's God. In Exodus 3 and verse 8 and verse 17. And that thought is repeated several times there. A good land, a land flowing with milk and honey. All right, let's look at another one. In Deuteronomy 1:25. Now this is Moses speaking here. We've had the testimony of God as he spoke to Moses. Now it is Moses who is speaking. It is a good land which the Lord our God giveth unto us. Deuteronomy 1 and verse 25. Furthermore, Jehovah was angry with me for your sakes. Now this is Moses speaking. This is Moses recounting the history of the Israelites. Furthermore, Jehovah was angry with me for your sakes and sware that I should not go over the Jordan, and that I should not go in unto that good land which Jehovah thy God giveth thee for an inheritance. All right, now I have a long passage here. I have it underlined. If I had the expertise of some people, I would have made the underlines where they come in like that. But I don't know how to do that. So we're just going to have to get by with the Stone Age. For Jehovah thy God bringeth thee into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs, flowing forth in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, and vines and fig trees and honey, a land wherein thou shalt eat bread without scarceness, thou shalt not lack anything in it. a land whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills thou mayest dig copper. And thou shalt eat and be full, and thou shalt bless the Lord thy God for the good land which he hath given thee." This is Moses' description of the land of Canaan, which he gives to the children of Israel as they are camped across the Jordan River from that land. They've already had the spies that have gone over 40 years before, and they know about that land. So for Moses to say it's a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs flowing forth in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, vines and fig trees and honey, where you'll eat bread without scarceness, and so on and so on. It sounds like that Moses thought that the land was indeed a very good and a very fine land to be enjoyed and appreciated by Israel. In Deuteronomy 11, verses 9 through 12, "And that you may prolong your days in the land which the Lord sware unto your fathers to give unto them and to their seed, a land flowing with milk and honey. For the land whither thou goest in to possess it is not as the land of Egypt, from whence ye came out, where thou sowedst thy seed and wateredst it with thy foot as a garden of herbs." In other words, Egypt was a land that the only way that you could grow anything, was to carry the water where you wanted it to grow. Once you got away from the banks of the Nile River, then there was absolutely nothing that would grow unless it was watered. And so the way they would water it would be they would have little trenches that would convey water. And so it was common to get out and use your foot because the ditches were very small and it would channel the water. And you would use your foot and you would... Like the water's running along here, and you want to divert it, so you just put your foot here, and you divert it into another little trench, or something like that. So when he talks about watering it with your foot, that's what he's talking about. It was very intensive farming and gardening down there in the land of Egypt, because they had to carry the water anywhere they grew anything. So Moses is saying it is not as the land of Egypt from which he came out, where you sowed your seed and watered it with your foot as a garden of herbs, but the land whither you go over to possess it is a land of hills and valleys and drinketh water of the rain of heaven, a land which the Lord thy God careth for. The eyes of the Lord thy God are always upon it from the beginning of the year even unto the end of the year. So in the passages we've looked at here, we've seen both God saying it's a great land, a good land, but also Moses. Moses said that. It wasn't just God and Moses, however, that said that it was a good land. In Numbers 13, 12 Israelite men were sent out to spy out the land of Canaan. They went over all the land from the north to the south. Now this would have been the time to straighten out the impression that this pathetic land was any good at all. Because these are the men who went and looked and had the knowledge to come back and say, "Well, this is what we found." But when they returned, they said, "Surely it floweth with milk and honey, and this is the fruit of it." And they brought back a cluster of grapes so huge that they had to put it on a stick for men to carry it. So those spies came back and they reported from their own survey, "Surely it flows with milk and honey, and this is the fruit of it." And then the people went into the land and they conquered the land. And toward the end of his life, Joshua spoke to the people of the good land which the Lord had given Israel. Joshua 23, verses 15 and 16. As we read in the book of Joshua about this land, we learn in Joshua 17, verses 15 and 18, that the area inhabited north of Jerusalem, or I could say the area situated north of Jerusalem, was covered by great forests. It was covered by great forests. The land where Ephraim and Manasseh would inherit. And when Ephraim and Manasseh went to Joshua to complain because their land was covered with great trees, not that it was arid, barren, and desert. They said, "Why, there's many trees here. We don't have room." Joshua said, "Well, listen, you're a great people. You yourselves have said that." It was pretty funny because Joshua just accepted. He used what they had said themselves. You know, "Hey, we are a great and noble people and a many people. You know, we ought to be able to have this." Okay, if you're that kind of people, that's your land. There's plenty of it. Cut the trees down. But it was covered with forests. Israel did not complain about the poverty of the land. Now, we all know Israel was in a mood to complain. They would not have been hesitant to complain. But they did not complain about the poverty of the land. And I want to give you just a brief survey of the book of Joshua. And this will be brief. The actions of Israel in the entire book of Joshua are described without criticism, except in the case of Achan in Joshua 7. And in the case of the Israelites accepting the story of the Gibeonites without asking advice of the Lord in Joshua 9, Achan stole some gold and some silver and a goodly Babylonish mantle. When God had said, "I'm giving you the city of Jericho so that you will not have to take the city of Jericho, I am giving you the city of Jericho. Therefore, whatever you find in the city, that goes to me, that comes to me, it is mine." Achan did not respect that. And so he took the gold and the silver and caused great damage upon Israel. In chapter 9, the Gibeonites from the city of Gibeon, not too far away from where the Israelites were encamped at the time, said, "If we go to them to make a treaty and they know we're from within the land, there is no way they're going to make a treaty with us. Therefore, we're going to go and pretend that we're from a long way off." And so if the whole thing was just a deception, and they came and they tricked Joshua and the Israelites into making that covenant with them, and Joshua and Israel made the mistake of not asking God through the Urim and the Thummim of the priest about the story. And so they wound up making that covenant when they would not have made it had they known otherwise. There's also the story of the Ephraimites, which I mentioned a moment ago, complaining, Joshua's own tribe, complaining that in their territory there were too many trees. And there was one more episode of difficulty, and that is in chapter 22. But it turned out to be to the honor of everyone. Reuben, Simeon, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh had sent their warriors from the east side over to the west side to help the other tribes finish taking the land. And when the fighting was over, and the west side had been taken, as the east side had been taken earlier, then the soldiers of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh were able to go on back home, on to the east side, across the Jordan. And when they went, they were thinking in their minds, they were saying, "You know, we're going to be separated by the river, and it might be easy for our brethren on the west side to forget in years to come that we who are on the east side are actually one with them. So why don't we do this?" And what they did was they built a very large altar after the model and the pattern of the bronze altar that was used for burnt offering. And it was made too big. It was built as a monument. It was not built to be used as an altar. And when the Western tribes saw what had been done, at first they were saying, "Oh no, the Eastern tribes are about to go into idolatry." And so they drew up their forces. They were about to go to battle over this thing. They weren't going to put up with idolatry. And when they came together, the Eastern tribes explained that we were afraid that it would be forgotten that we are part of you. So we built this altar, this big altar, as a monument, so that if ever a question came up about whether we were one or not, we could say, "Well, look, we built this altar here after the model of your brazen altar, just to show you." And so everybody accepted that. They felt good about that. And so they did not feel that they had to battle over that. So, like I say, that was a difficulty, but it didn't have anything to do with their not being happy with the land. And in chapters 23 and 24, Joshua was seeking to assure that upon his death, the children of Israel would continue to serve God. Let me let you turn with me for a moment to that last chapter, Joshua 24. In Joshua 24, now when you get your Bible open there, realize that the last thing you have in Joshua, you have two speeches. One of the speeches is in 23, and one of the speeches in 24. And both of these seem to be very closely related here. I think they are closely related, even time-wise. I think they're closely related. I think that 24 follows upon 23. Now, Joshua knows he's going to die. And just like Moses, when he knew that he was going to die, was concerned about whether Israel would continue in the ways of the Lord. And he was concerned about what would happen to Israel if they did not. Because Moses loved his people. And he wanted them to be safe. And he wanted them to be able to enjoy the land. Over and over and over again, Moses in the book of Deuteronomy would say, "Keep the word of the Lord. Walk in the ways of the Lord. Don't turn to the right. Don't turn to the left. That you may prolong your days in the land which God gives you." Well, Joshua had the same concern about his people as well. He wanted his people to do well. He wanted them to be able to stay in the land. But in chapter 24, he gathers all the tribes together, calls for the elders and their heads and judges and officers, and they presented themselves before God as Joshua, who is the ordained, appointed leader of God's people at this time, and he talks with them. And first of all, what he tells them is of their own past. He just tells them about their history, the history which we have studied, a history which they would have known, and about how they were brought into the land. And so in verse 13, notice this verse. Because Joshua is expressing the words of Jehovah. And God says, "And I gave you a land whereon thou hadst not labored, and cities which ye built not, and ye dwell therein, of vineyards and olive yards, which ye planted not, do ye eat." The Lord was referring to the very words He used in a speech that Moses gave. God inspired Moses to give that speech in Deuteronomy 11, where Moses had used almost identical language. And so here you are, a land that you haven't labored on, cities you did not build, vineyards and olive yards that you did not plant, and yet you eat of those things. You know what he's saying up to that point? He's saying, God has blessed you with incredible blessings. That is the huge fundamental point that Joshua was making. God has blessed you unbelievably. Verse 14, "Now therefore, in view of how God has blessed you, fear the Lord and serve Him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river. In other words, don't have anything to do. He's not telling them you're a bunch of idolaters. That is not what He's telling them. But idolatry was in the history of Israel, and it would be again. And Joshua was very aware of that. So he was seeking to persuade them, put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve ye the Lord. So it's not only their forefathers in the land of Mesopotamia, the gods that were served before Abraham's day, but it was also in Egypt. And serve ye the Lord. And then when he says in verse 15, if it seem evil, he is not saying that you're just terrible people. And so, no, all he's doing is he's wanting them to understand as they contemplate the future, as they contemplate their conduct. He says, now, if it seems evil to you, in other words, if that's just what you don't want to do, if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, then you choose this day whom you're going to serve. I've told you before that this verse has been used without really paying attention to what it's saying. Because what he's saying is, if you're not going to serve Jehovah, then what choices do you have? You have a choice of a bunch of things that are equal, and they're equally no good. If it seems evil to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom ye will serve. Will it be the gods that your fathers served beyond the river? Or will it be the gods of the Amorites in whose land we now dwell? In other words, that's not much of a choice. The true choice. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And Israel answered, far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. I believe that the generation, the invasion generation of Israel, was arguably one of the finest, if not the finest, generation of Israel in all their history. And so they were strongly moved by what Joshua said here. So his words in verse 15 do not indicate that he was tired of dealing with a stubborn and rebellious people. No, we don't see that. That's not there. The evidence is not there. It is not in Joshua. He was admonishing them to fear the Lord, and if they did not want to do that, then he was saying, here are your choices. Your choices were only idolatry. Either the idolatry of their forefathers beyond the river Euphrates, or the idolatry of Egypt, or the idolatry of the land that they now lived in. But the bottom line is, there is no indication in the book of Joshua that the Israelites were unhappy with the land. The Bible record is very clear that Canaan was a nice land. It was a wonderful land, a good land. But God never said, it's the very best land in all the world. He didn't say that. He didn't have to say that. It was a good land. It was a great land. But you take any land in the world, and almost any land will have different kind of terrain in it. And the amazing thing about the land of Canaan was, as small as it was in comparison with some really big nations, it had an absolutely amazing variety of terrain in it. It is mind-boggling when you study how small the land actually was and then how much terrain it had in it. You had, like down at Jericho, the temperature could reach 110 in the summer. That'd be the place to spend the winter. And some of the kings knew that. and did it. Up on the ridge of the hill country, it occasionally snowed. And the farther north you went, the more likelihood that you could see some snow in the winter. And some of the stories told in the Bible have to do with snow. Like one of my favorites is about one of the great heroes of David named Benaiah, who became the leader of the Kerethites and the Pelethites, his own personal bodyguard. This Benaiah was a fellow that, I don't know if he tracked him or learned of it. He learned that there was a lion that was caught in a cistern or a pit. And he went down in there and killed the lion. Anyone want to compare courage with Benaiah? And it was in the time of snow. In the time of snow. God had other reasons for wanting Israel there besides the fact it was a good land. It was a good land. But He had other reasons He wanted them to be there. He wanted them to be there also because Egypt was on the one hand, Mesopotamia up on the other. That meant that as men of that whole area passed through that little land bridge, that fertile land bridge there that Canaan was, they would be exposed to the God of heaven and earth. They would be exposed to Jehovah, the true God. Also, this would give God a very good way to be able to chastise His people to try to guide them in the right way. Because He could put them in the hands of this enemy or that enemy to try to bring them back to Him. And notice this, neither did He say that no matter what they did, it would always be a wonderful land. In fact, as we said at the beginning of our lesson, the third option is that something happened to a once good land. And I think this is a factor which plays very heavily in modern day Israel. I want to show you some passages on this point. This is passages from Leviticus 26. That's perhaps the earliest passage where God actually shows consequences of disobedience that will follow. This reminds us of passages over in Deuteronomy 28 and 29. Look at what He says here. This is, of course, if you are unfaithful, if you seek after other gods and so on, then shall the land enjoy its Sabbaths as long as it lieth desolate, and ye are in your enemy's land. Even then shall the land rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. As long as it lieth desolate, it shall have rest. Even the rest which it had not in your Sabbaths when you dwelt upon it. I think there we find a key to one of the ways that God used to bring His threat about the land and the way it would be ruined if they turned away from Him. He commanded them that every seventh year was to be a Sabbath for the whole year. They were not to plant anything that year, but to let the land lie fallow. That would allow the land time to regenerate, recover its fertility, and so on. They didn't do that. They did not do that. Over and over and over, year after year after year, 7 years after 7 years after 7 years, they did not do that. And one of the points made is that I'm going to catch up. I'm going to catch up on all those Sabbath years that you missed out on, that because you just didn't observe them. I'm going to let the land catch up. I'm going to let it rest. I'm going to let it have the rest that you did not give it. Deuteronomy 29, would you turn to that, please? If you can't turn to it, then just listen carefully. But it was way too long a passage for me to write on the screen. So I just wanted to turn to it and read it. Now then, as we read this passage, remember that this is being said with the children of Israel over on the east side. They haven't yet gone across to the west side, which is Canaan itself. And they're about to go over there. And so Moses is really, he's coming to the close of his life and coming to the close of this speech. Now listen to what he says. If they do not follow the ways of the Lord, he says, the generation to come, your children that shall rise up after you, and the foreigner that shall come from a far land. Now here I can put in parentheses, even from the USA, shall say, when they see the plagues of that land and the sicknesses wherewith Jehovah hath made it sick, and that the whole land thereof is brimstone and salt and a burning, that it is not sown nor beareth, nor any grass groweth therein, like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboiim, which Jehovah overthrew in his anger and his wrath. Even all the nations shall say, wherefore hath the Lord done thus unto this land? What meaneth the heat of this great anger? Then men shall say, because they forsook the covenant of Jehovah, the God of their fathers, which he made with them when he brought them forth out of the land of Egypt, and went and served other gods, and worshipped them, gods that they knew not, and that he had not given unto them. Therefore the anger of the Lord was kindled against the land, to bring upon it all the curse that is written in this book. Do you see that? And they will say, and the Lord rooted them out of their land in anger and in wrath and in great indignation and cast them into another land as at this day. And then the last verse, the secret things belong unto the Lord our God, but the things that are revealed belong unto us and to our children forever. This prediction that the land would be ruined, that does not mean it was ruined when they moved into it. They moved into it, and by their conduct, they caused this promise to be fulfilled. Notice here in 2 Chronicles 36, the last chapter, almost the last verse, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths, for as long as it lay desolate, it kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. 70 years. As I mentioned a moment ago, I believe that these passages imply that Israel, among the other things they did not do, they did not observe the sabbatical years, as the Lord commanded, a year of solemn rest for the land. And this contributed to the deterioration of the land. And I think even beyond that, God in His own ways caused the prophecy of Deuteronomy 29 to be fulfilled in the blasting of the land and so on. So God did not mislead the people in promising them a wonderful land. Oh no, God does not mislead. And when God promises, it is a wonderful thing that He promises. God did not mislead the people, neither did Moses. It was a good land, and there is no record of the Israelites denying that it was a good land or complaining that it was not. There's a great deal of variety in the land of Israel, as I mentioned a while ago. And it is a grave mistake to look at the land around the spot where one might be standing, and decide, whole land is like this. I mean, can you imagine that? You're standing in one spot, you're looking one area around you, you know, go over and visit. You're looking at one spot, you say, wow, boy, this is a terrible land. This whole thing like this? If you go a few miles, what would it be like then? Now, I said at the beginning that even of ancient times, there probably is no doubt in my mind that once you got over that ridge in the area later called the wilderness of Judea or the wilderness of Judah, that you had some pretty bad rugged territory over there. But there was a very big land full of all kinds of room for people. One of the things that I think about, and I try to help people to understand this. See, on the one hand, we try to help people to understand it was a little land compared to the United States. About 150 miles long. And so you and I, in our cars and planes and everything, we say, 150 miles, ha ha. Walk 150 miles. You take everybody's cars away, and 150 miles is a whole lot bigger. There was plenty of room for 12 tribes to live in this land and have everything they needed and have everything they wanted if their wants were not out of bounds. Just like you and I, we have everything we need and everything we want unless our wants are out of bounds. But it's a grave mistake to look at the land around the spot where one might be standing and decide that the whole land is like that, or to decide that this is the way the land looked when Israel came into it, and then to judge God as being dishonest because He had promised a good land. We dare not do that. We dare not even imply that that is the case. However, through her failure to obey God's precepts, Israel brought on the land the curses that God had promised them would come. So God gave them a good land. But through their disobedience to God and their rejection of His will, they brought the curse of God upon the land. And according to Deuteronomy 29, that is one of the purposes served when we observe the land today. When we come from our far nations and we see it and we observe the land, we are to think, what does this mean? And you and I know what it means. But our God is a good God. Heaven is not going to be passable. It's going to be wonderful. Salvation is not going to be fair. It's going to be, and is, great. God is the giver of all good and perfect gifts, James says. Are you a Christian? If you're not, why not be a Christian tonight? Believe that Jesus is the Christ. Turn away from sin. Confess your faith. Be baptized to have your sins forgiven. If you're a Christian but you're not living as a Christian should, you want to make your life right, repent and get back in the way with God again, we'd like to encourage you to do this. So whatever your situation may be, if we can be of encouragement to you, come as we stand and sing.